It is now near universally accepted in Western liberal culture that consent is required for good sex. But is it sufficient for it? The old ethics of sex, which was only interested in whether the parties were married, has been replaced by the new ruling ethic of consent. According to this ethic, sex that is consensual is, ergo, legitimate and valuable. The Me Too movement put some strain on this ruling ethic. Many of its related scandals involved activity which, although clearly wrong, arguably did meet the bar of consent. Second-wave feminists, moreover, have long derided the consent standard for legitimating far too much sex which is morally flawed and trades on inequality. By valorizing consent so much, have we obscured the possible harms of consensual sex? And what are those harms if the sex was, indeed, freely agreed to? I'm Kate Greasley, an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Oxford, where I teach and research on the law of sexual offences and the philosophy of consent. In Oxford Conversations on Consent, I speak to scholars of law and philosophy about the ethics of consent, sexual wrongdoing, and the wider themes of the Me Too movement. Robin West is Professor of Law and Philosophy Emeritus at Georgetown Law School. She has written widely on feminist legal theory and the law and ethics of consent. In this conversation, I speak to Robin about how consent came to be the marker of valid sexual conduct, some drawbacks of consent culture, and the radical feminist critique of consent. Robin West, thank you very much for having this conversation with me.
Thank you.
So I'm tentatively entitling this conversation, What's Wrong with Consent? Because a lot of what we're going to speak about are certain harms that you have identified in your work as stemming from, I guess, this exclusive focus on consent, almost an obsession with consent, maybe, that has now kind of taken hold, or has for a long time, in the ethics of sex. Even though I think, as is going to be made clear as we speak, your critique of consent is starkly different, you know, very importantly different from what's understood to be the radical feminist critique of consent. But I wondered if we could perhaps begin by talking about how we got to this point, with the role that consent now plays both legally and socially in regulating sex, because clearly it wasn't always thus. In the past, you know, consent was really not the issue. It's a relatively recent development that this is what everything turns on, that the licitness of sex. So, and you know, you've written about this extensively, the history of this. So how was sex regulated before consent became dominant? And then, you know, when and how did that sea change take place as you see it?
Yes, so it took place not at any particular point, but over time. I think it can be described this way. Before consent, rape was defined in all 50 states and much of the rest of the world as sex by force, with utmost resistance, with a woman not one's wife. And that eventually, as you said, gave way to a complete overhaul definitionally of rape as being sex without consent. So how did you go from the first to the second? Let me start with the conventional definition. Rape is sex by force with utmost resistance with a woman not one's wife. Three separate requirements. So starting at the end of that, the woman not one's wife part. This was the most important demarcation of sex from rape for centuries. So what did it signify? Well, the line between legal sex and illegal sex was drawn by marital status, not by anything having to do with force or consent. Even violent and non-consensual or forced sex within marriage was legal. Within marriage, all sex legal, even what we today would characterize as rape or sexual assault. And outside marriage, likewise, it wasn't consent. Even fully consensual sex outside of marriage was illegal. So it was clearly the marriage status that did the most work in demarcating legal from illegal sex. Okay, so that was that's sort of the oldest chunk of this. The utmost resistance requirement, I'm not sure the history, I don't know when it started showing up in U.S. state definitions of rape, but it was there for a long time. And it was also the first of the three definitional criteria to fall. It fell even before the marital rape exemption fell. The likely it fell, in other words, utmost resistance meant that for sex to be recognized as forced and therefore as rape, the victim had to resist to the utmost. She had to fight back. She had to have scars or scratches that evidenced that there was a fight. She had to resist as much as she could. Otherwise, it was presumably desired, presumably consensual, presumably not something she cared about that much. So the virtuous woman would resist to the utmost was the underlying idea there. Okay, why did that one fall? This is pretty clear. Police forces, as well as liberal feminists, but police forces centrally started advising women not to resist rape because resisting rape endangers your life in a way that passive acquiescence does not. So that became the sort of standard part of the attitudes of police forces toward non-consensual sex was that the utmost resistance requirement is a real problem. It's endangering women's lives. That got the attention of legislators, and the utmost resistance requirement started falling by the wayside. Okay, then you're left with, and then the marital rape exemption, that's a 30-40 year history of trying to get rid of the marital rape exemption, and it's largely a successful movement. Not entirely. There's still differences between rape within marriage and rape outside marriage. But for the most part, the marital rape exemption has also fallen. That leaves the force requirement. So to a group of first liberal feminists, but then legislators, and then eventually the culture, understanding rape as sex by force looked at first under-inclusive, that it did not reach sex that was not accompanied by weapons or fists, but should be criminalized, should be at least regulated.
Other forms of coercion, in effect.
Yes, yes. In part because it was in fact non-consensual, even though it was forced, or it appears to some to have been non-consensual. To others, it appears consensual. But at any rate, it looks like sex that should be criminalized. So that included a lot of date rape, a lot of marital rape, and even acquaintance rape. The rallying cry among liberal feminists of the 80s was that all non-consensual sex should be criminalized, not just non-consensual sex that's accompanied by fists and weapons, but any sex that is non-consensual should therefore be understood to be criminal. Okay, so the valuation of women's autonomy was always really at the heart of this movement. If you read all that literature, the rape scholarship from the 80s, from the 90s, into the 2000s, autonomy is clearly the value that is being promoted by the move from force to consent. The consent requirement respects women's choices to engage or not engage in sex. The value that's being promoted is autonomy and free choice. Worry that was initially expressed by Catherine MacKinnon and then by many others that you called a minute ago, the radical feminist critique of the consent standard. I think that's correct. I mean, I do think that's a fair characterization. Was basically this, that the consent standard alone runs the risk that it will be under-inclusive, that it doesn't pick up enough sex that should be criminalized that isn't if all you focus on is consent. Okay.
Right. So the issue there maybe is less, could we say, you know, the idea of consent having to be the dividing line, and maybe more to do with what we call consent and what we're willing to, or what the law is willing to call consensual and what it isn't willing to call.
Yes,
consensual.
It puts all the weight on that, right? It puts all the weight on deciphering and applying a standard that is overwhelmingly, the content of it is overwhelmingly dictated by cultural attitudes. The conclusion drawn was that there's a problem with putting so much weight on consent. So you need a different marker for the difference between legal and illegal sex in a society in which consent is so widely presumed.
But if you don't trust those, basically, if you don't trust whoever it is who is the arbiter of consent, then you're going
to
be highly suspicious.
You're in trouble.
Can we, I wonder if we could backtrack to kind of
where we're at now, so as we were saying, surely, yes, consent and caring about autonomy and this being the dividing line is an improvement over, you know, you can't be raped within marriage and resist to the utmost. Like, for sure, it's an improvement on that. But then what I find really interesting about a lot of your work is that you've then gone and kind of charted some of the perils and some of the pitfalls in what you describe as, you know, the over-reliance on consent, right, maybe in the social and ethical domain, to demarcate ethically correct from ethically incorrect sex. And you call some of these harms and costs legitimation costs.
Right.
So this is not you saying, you know, consent doesn't matter, this shouldn't have happened, but you seem to be kind of just wanting to maybe flag some dangers of thinking that, well, as soon as we have consent, or, you know, consent is the thing that makes sex absolutely fine and perfect and okay, these dangers come into the fore. So I wonder if you could say a bit about what you mean by this term legitimation costs.
So I wanted to introduce, when I started articulating this, a different critique of consent and consensual sex in particular, although the same critique of consent can apply to non-sexual transactions such as sales and labor. Mm-hmm. Labor, I think, more importantly. But defining rape as non-consensual sex raises the problem that everything that gets a pass is legitimated. Mm-hmm. So defining rape as non-consensual sex means that sex that is not rape, that is presumably consensual, is thereby legitimated. It comes to
being kind of celebrated, valued.
Celebrated, valued, but minimally not criticized. You can't critique it. I mean, that's one thing that's one way the Me Too movement got, I think, misunderstood, but also is sort of invited misunderstanding, because they tried to critique it, but you have to be clear. And so the consent requirement for rape versus sex leaves consensual sex ethically untouchable, beyond reproach, and, as you said, at the extreme, just always celebrated, always a good thing. And I think, particularly in sort of pro-sex days, which we're kind of in now, but not always, but not completely, not as much as we were in the aughts, maybe, in the teens, and the 1990s, consensual sex is doubly celebrated as both consensual and as sexual. So if sex is always good and consent is always wonderful, then consensual sex is sort of doubly always good, right?
This is a fallacy.
Right, so it leaves a lot of consensual sex untouchable or beyond reproach. I have identified in my writing, as you indicated, two different kinds of costs. One is legitimation costs and the other is hedonic dysphoria. Mm-hmm. But the basic point underlying both is that in a culture that prioritizes, and I would say fetishizes, consent, it leaves unwanted, unwelcome sex, as well as unwanted and unwelcome transactions that are non-sexual, really beyond critique, and that has harms. So what is unwanted sex? Before I move to the legitimation cost, what is it? What are some examples of it? Well, sex that is not wanted, not welcome, not pleasurable, that's the most restrictive definition, mm-hmm. But is nevertheless consensual. Why would one consent to unwelcome, unwanted sex? Well, to ward off a partner's bad mood, to ensure that the money's left on the counter for the kids' school lunches, because it's expected by one's faith, because it's expected by one's community, to ward off threats of future violence, which may not even count as coercion legally, but certainly don't count as force or violence, mm-hmm. sex to satisfy the expectations of one's peers in a hookup culture, et cetera, guilt mm-hmm. or shame-induced sex, where one believes that it's unwanted or unwelcome because of some flaw of one's own, sex because it's the expected return for a dinner on a date, sex because it's expected by the culture, et cetera. So there are many, many, many reasons.
That you, in your writing, kind of underscore what you call hookup culture as sort of culturally mandated sex, because I think when most people think about kind of sex in softly coercive circumstances, which maybe passes the bar of consent, but is in some way kind of tainted or grey area, I think they usually think about kind of power imbalances, you know, a wife who can't afford to divorce her husband, you know, that sort of thing. But it's interesting that you pick on this as well, which is, it's much more diffuse, kind of, it's peer pressure, basically. It's the kind of virginity in college kind of sort of pressure.
It's more diffuse. It's also, I mean, thinking about all of this as the result of power dynamics might be descriptively true in some ways, but it also is isn't all that helpful, and I don't think that it always identifies the harm correctly.
Right.
Power imbalances are pervasive. There's a disparity of power in any transaction between any two people. So it isn't clear that it's helpful. There may be a power imbalance between a faculty member and a graduate student who is not in that faculty member's program and so on. If one thinks it's the power imbalance per se that makes sex suspect, then those relationships are out of bounds. And the same is true of all workforces. And so focusing on the power, I think, both further hides the subjectivity of these harms, which I think needs to be articulated, but also introduces an over-inclusive problems of its own.
Sure.
Okay, legitimation cost as a phrase just means that you're overvaluing whatever was consented to by virtue of the fact that it was consented to. And again, that can happen in non-sexual as well as sexual realms. It also, another legitimation cost, using consent as the demarcation of legal versus illegal also legitimates the conditions that made the consensual attraction, transaction appear to be good. And those conditions might indeed involve a lot of coercion, but they might involve some of these more diffuse cultural elements as well. So if a labor contract is consensual, if it's presumed to be good for both parties, then it legitimates whatever's wrong with that, with that labor site, which might be a lot, right? It might be unhealthy, it might be dangerous, it might be low paid, it might be too many hours, and so on. If consent, if the fact that the labor contract was consensual
makes everything okay, yeah.
Everything's okay, yeah. Beyond critique, then you're never going to get there. This was Marx's early point. It's pretty
right.
Basic.
So there's an analog there. That's
yeah. There's an analog to labor. Yeah. There's also an analog to sales. If you think that every term in a sales contract is legitimate because the contract was consented to, then you're legitimating a lot of things like non-disclosure clauses and mandatory arbitration and so on. So, okay, it doesn't follow from the fact of consent that that which was consented to is good. It only follows that it's not bad because it was non-consensual. So the fact that a labor contract is not slavery doesn't make the labor good. The fact that a transaction is not theft doesn't make it good. It just means that it's not bad because non-consensual. It might be bad for other reasons. Okay, likewise, the fact that sex is consensual doesn't mean it's therefore good, right? It might be bad, but for other reasons. And that's really, so that's really all that legitimation cost
right.
means, kind
it's
of analytic.
Masking something, masking maybe a whole panoply of problems.
Disappear. Right. And in a liberal society in which, we vote, so we've consented to all of this crap. Consent every time we get in our car, every time we walk down the street, we're consenting to what, it can be at such an extreme level that it looks absurd, but nevertheless, in a democracy where the sole rationale for democracy is that it rests on the consent of the governed, you have that legitimation cost problem writ large.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
If patriarchy is like democracy in that way, then you have the legitimation problem writ large in the sexual realm, right. in the same sort of way.
So I guess thinking about the kind of the problems that are masked,
right.
What could be wrong with all this consensual sex? I guess many things, many, many things, but you kind of zero in on very particular things that haven't really received very much attention, especially with this idea of hedonic dysphoria.
Right, correct. And so some of what's legitimated is the power imbalance, as you suggested a moment ago. And that's what most people criticizing consent, but who, like me, nevertheless think consent should be the demarcation, but who nevertheless are critical of consent, have focused on the legitimation of the power imbalance as the problem. My thought is that there's another legitimation cost, and that is that it legitimates the subjective being that follows. And part of that subjective being is what I started calling hedonic dysphoria. So, so what is that? Well, I don't think it happens every time somebody has sex that they don't want. That was in answer to one of your questions. But if one consents to sex and consents to a lot over it over a long time, such as an entire adulthood, then I do think it leads to what I call hedonic dysphoria, by which I mean a girl or a woman, it can also be a boy or a man or cis, whatever, who no longer regards her own pleasures and pains as determinative, even partially determinative, of herself or of her choices or of her desires or of her preferences. Pain and pleasure just sort of disappear from one's internality. Jeremy Bentham famously said in his defense of utilitarianism that pleasure and pain determine what we do and what we don't do. But what if over an adult life, they don't determine what we do and what we don't do, but the pleasure and the pain of someone else determines what we do and what we don't do? Okay, in a way, that's the definition of servitude, but it also may be the definition of oppression. But it also, I think, and quite sort of vividly, is what happens when one's own very physical pains and pleasures are regarded as irrelevant to one's choices, one's desires, one's preferences, and then what one does in the world. Pleasure and pain not only become muted, they lose significance. We're not doing what pleases us, we're not avoiding what pains us, and in some profound way, I think, that destroys selfhood.
That, selfhood.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah. That even if Bentham overstated it and all of that, there's something to the idea, right? That pleasure and pain determine your desires, and your desires determine your preferences, and your preferences determine your choices, and your choices is what makes you an individual and impactful in the world. Well, if that chain is broken at the very beginning, where your pains and pleasures are not determining any of that, in some important way, you're not a self. As constructed in liberal culture, I mean, in early writing, I call this you're a giving self, but at any rate, the traditional liberal understanding of selfhood, right, is that it's your preferences and your desires that determine your choices. What's determining those preferences and desires? Well, a whole bunch of stuff, but pleasures and pains in part, right? I mean, you may have.
I mean, this is all super interesting to me. Also, because, you know, when I read this, you know, I'd never read anything like it. I hadn't read, you know, a critique about precisely this. And I was kind of wondering, you know, how would you recite this concern to, say, like an 18-year-old girl? Having like loads of sex with different guys, or, you know, and is saying, but the truth is, none of it is really doing anything for me. I just kind of do it. I don't know. Would you be talking to her about, I don't know, I guess you're kind of alienating in some way your part of you from important parts of who you are, or you're like denigrating yourself because you're behaving as if your own pleasure and pain doesn't matter? Is kind of that the kernel of the?
Yeah, I think both of those are true, and both of those might spark some self-understanding or recognition. But I do think that's the relevant question. I at one point I was talking to a bunch of people that do sex education for Planned Parenthood, including my stepdaughter. Yeah, and I asked her if I asked a number of people this. The answer was always the same: what is taught to teachers of sex ed, and what do the teachers teach in sex education classes about the ethical conditions of good sex? And the answer was always consent. You have to make sure that both parties are consenting. So one way to put this point, and it seems trivial and obvious, but it's not apparently, is that consent is necessary but not sufficient. And so what both parties should be asking is if the sex is wanted and welcomed and desired. Each party should be asking that of him or herself and of the partner. And so just effectuating that shift in the way we talk to teenagers, and it's not just 18-year-olds, it's 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and 17-year-olds, about their budding sexuality, and talk about it so that they understand that pleasure is a precondition and pain is an absolute no, then that, I think, is an advance. It's a hedonic advance for everybody. You get more pleasure in the world and less pain. But it's also, I think, an advance in the way that you were saying. You have less self-alienation and you have less self-denigration, because it's clearly denigrating to think about your own pleasure and pain not mattering in this realm. It might not matter in other realms if you're engaging in, you know, altruistic community service or something.
Right. I was thinking about this when I read about, was reading you on hedonic dysphoria as well. I was wondering if the point is very specific to sex, or maybe if just the weightiness of it, the importance of it, is specific to sex, because, you know, I was imagining, I don't know, someone who goes to the theater a lot, you know, because that's what their friends do, and they kind of tell themselves they enjoy it, but really, it's like pulling teeth for them, and they do all the time. You know, is there kind of a hedonic dysphoria problem? I mean, I'm guessing you would say, well, no, it's not. It's not kind of the same level of seriousness, and that's kind of key to the argument here, to the harm, that it's specifically to do with one's body and one's kind of immediate pleasure and pain. It's it's not just anything.
It has to do with the fact that it's the body, and again, with the longevity of it, if this extends over time, is always the case. And then, I mean, the person who goes to the theater because their friends like it, is aware of it, is aware of that disjunction. Even the way you just put it, it's like, it feels like pulling teeth, but I do it anyway. Because I'm getting other sorts of pleasures, or because I enjoy giving pleasure to my friends. And, that's harmless. It could be admirable. The same is true, of course, with sex. And you asked that at some point, is this always harmful? No, of course not. And unwanted, unpleasurable sex can be a part of a loving relationship that is, and so it's worthwhile for that reason, if it contributes to the strength of a healthy relationship.
Right. So it's not that you think it's always the case that if somebody engages in sexual activity that they don't particularly desire in the moment, you know, there's this hedonic dysphoria is going on. It's a question of longevity and maybe the circumstances to some extent as well, and the motivations maybe.
Yeah, I mean, my point is that this can be harmful, not that it necessarily is harmful, but that it can be harmful, and it is particularly harmful if it's indulged in over time. I do think it relates to other forms of female denigration. One example I used to use, there was this, there was a movement in law schools. Wait, I'm sorry, I never asked you. Are you a lawyer?
I am. I'm sort of.
Okay. So you may remember this. There was a big movement in the 80s, I guess, to track the number of times women volunteer in law school compared to the number of times men volunteer in law school. Who raises their hand? Who gets called?
Volunteer me, yeah.
Who raise their hands? Mm-hmm. How they're responded to, how their peers respond when a woman talks, is there eye rolling? Is she treated respectfully by the professor, and so on? But the main one was just quantitative. How often do men raise their hands versus how often do women? It was a pretty shocking disparity.
I don't think it would be shocking to me having been in law school.
Right. I mean, it continues. It certainly does continue.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's as bad as it used to be. But at any rate, I think that's a manifestation of some of this. I mean, I don't know that there's a one-to-one correlation. But if one constantly denigrates oneself in this physical realm, that's not far from denigrating oneself intellectually.
You think these two things are not unrelated? If someone's kind
They're
of
living
a life in which they are just routinely kind of subjecting their body to something which people are telling them is enjoyable, but which they don't find enjoyable.
Right.
Does something to the psyche, or the way the person thinks about themselves, which runs in a direct line to they're the kind of person who might not want to kind of push themselves forward.
That's right. And so it leads to this thinking of I'm in pain, but it doesn't matter because I don't matter. Mm-hmm. I'm in pain because it doesn't matter because the pain is actually trivial. Or I'm in pain, but it doesn't matter because I'm misunderstanding the pain.
Right.
Actually, it's pleasure, and I'm feeling it as pain.
This is kind of gaslighting, because I think at one point you put this in terms of gaslighting. It's almost kind of social gaslighting into thinking something must be pleasurable because it's this and it's consented to.
Right. And then if you're not consenting, there's either something wrong with you, or you just don't matter, or you're confused. And that leads to a lot of confusion and a lot of self-denigration.
I think we mentioned Me Too very briefly earlier in relation to this. And I was wondering, if you have a view on a general view on what the Me Too movement has done with regards to buy-in to the ethic of sex. You know, has it kind of bolstered consent as the be-all and end-all of the ethics of sex? Or might there be an argument to say in some ways the Me Too movement has kind of exposed the problems with regarding consent as the only thing that matters.
Okay, so yeah, it's a double-edged thing.
Mm.
First of all, to back up just a second, sexual harassment law does not define the actionable sex, think about just quid pro quo, as non-consensual. It defines it as unwelcome. So that sort of opens the door. Sexual harassment law and sexual harassment itself is unwanted and unwelcome sex in the workplace or in various places, schools and workplaces. So that at least introduced the concept, and the Me Too movement, in the most literal sense, just exposed how widespread that is. Unwelcome and unwanted sex in the workplace or in schools is a large problem. So the on the plus side, the Me Too movement exposed and set out to expose and did expose the amount of sexual harassment in the world. If people understand that sexual harassment is defined in that way as unwelcome sex rather than as non-consensual sex, then that goes a long way toward resetting the line between what's acceptable and unacceptable sex, because it resets the line in a legal context, not a criminal law context, but in a nevertheless in a civil rights and tort-based understanding. And it did lead then to some success, to a lot of successful lawsuits. The Me Too movement led to a lot of successful lawsuits and at least some criminal convictions as well of powerful men. Okay, on the other hand, first of all, there was a backlash, but part of the backlash was that some of what women are complaining about in the Me Too movement just looks like bad sex.
Right.
As opposed to anything that is a worry.
Right.
And so bad sex can't just be a worry. So that's what's wrong with these movies.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I feel that in some of the these cases, these kind of, you know, famous Me Too cases, not all, but of course, but some of them, you feel like there's almost a kind of a desperate effort to understand an interaction as non-consensual, right? You know, and to have an argument about it purely in terms of consent. Because if it's not non-consensual, I think people are at a loss to then explain.
Just say what's wrong with it.
What was the problem?
That's correct. That's correct. And so, yeah, you did see that all over the place. You saw it in women's centers on universities, that women would come in and they would have some unease about what's going on with their sex lives and with their sex, and they would try to express it in a way that emphasized non-consensual features. In part because I think we lack a language to talk about what's wrong with sex when it is consensual, but nevertheless bad. And so the backlash to Me Too was in part that it contributed to this sense that consensual sex, no matter what else is true of it, is going to be harmless.
So I guess a kind of, there's an implied premise here, which I think is a correct premise, which is that, you know, consent is a kind of a minimum condition on sex being, you know, legitimate, good, valuable, all of these things. And then I suppose that kind of, you know, raises the question about the law, because
right.
You know, you're thinking about outside of the law, and how, you know, how would you advise, you know, young people, can, you know, on the precipice of becoming sexually active, to engage in sex, to think about the ethics of sex, and that's sort of one question. And I think the legitimation costs of consent are clearly like very, very salient there. And then there's kind of the question of what should the legal threshold be? And we're talking about problems with consent, but I guess a lot of people will always want to hear bring things back to that and know about that. So, I mean, do you think that there ought to be space for lawful sex that is nonetheless bad sex in various ways, possibly one of those ways being, you know, power imbalance, you know, abusive power imbalance, which nonetheless meet the threshold of consent, you know, so long as consent is present. I mean, do you think it's important that we have, you know, that gap between what the law insists on and what is ethically ideal?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important that we insist on that. First of all, obviously, you cannot criminalize all consensual sex that's bad. And so that can't be understood as a goal, as a sensible goal. We wouldn't want to do that. One way to put this problem is that critiques of consensual sex run the danger of being of having to go through what I call a force funnel, that you have to describe it as forced. It has to be coerced. It has to be involuntary, violent, forced, coercive, in order for the criticism, even one's own reflective criticism, to gain traction. And so that's the lack of a gap. What a gap would do would be to give you a way to describe sex that you have or have had, or that you're contemplating having, as not forced, fully consensual, not coerced, but nevertheless something to be avoided because of some harm that it might occasion. I think that this tendency to understand rape as forced sex, and then to understand everything that's bad, if sex is bad, as a function of force and power, right, is just a mistake. But it's a very understandable mistake, and particularly in a liberal culture, like leave sex out of it altogether. The same thing happens with capitalism generally, right? The fact that we're not in a slave society doesn't mean that everything that happens that's consensual in our work life and in our transactional life is good. And that assumption underlies virtually the entire administrative state, right? That there are going to be harms in sales and in commerce and in labor that aren't captured by these images of theft or slavery. And we just haven't made that step in with sexuality, that there are harms of fully consensual sex that's not rape, sex that's nowhere near, sex that's not even sexual harassment, that nevertheless need to be articulated and spelled out. It doesn't mean we need an administrative apparatus to cope with all that. And so your question, you know, what should be the legal response to all this? I'm not sure that there should be a legal response other than to take care to avoid the slippery slope, other than to take care to avoid the legitimation cost. So the legitimation cost is a cost of the legal system, I think. It's a cost that's a function of law.
Right. Because when the law articulates a certain standard as being the standard, there's a kind of temptation to just take it wholesale as a moral ideal.
Yeah, it obliterates the moral realm, right, which is a problem generally in legal systems with even a very well-functioning rule of law. There's that problem that if morality is associated with sort of 19th century Victorian norms, then there's no space in which to engage in serious critical moral thinking about transactions that you don't want touched by law. Okay, but it doesn't have to be that law exits the field altogether. It's already entered the field in the sexual harassment context, as I said. I do think that the Me Too movement, as well as the anti-sexual harassment movement, would benefit by a richer vocabulary to describe what is meant by unwelcome sex, since that has become the legal standard in the realm of school and work. Now, it's the legal standard there because of power imbalances, right? So in work and school, it's that sex that's unwelcome and that can be actionable is embedded in what's recognized quite formally as a imbalance of power. And so the tricky thing is to figure out how to think about unwelcome sex that is not necessarily tied to any such formal power imbalance, and then how to talk about it, and then how to talk about the costs and the benefits of worrying over it. I mean, this is implied by one of your thoughts about how you talk to an 18-year-old. I think that a lot of the weight here has to be on education and just on the promulgation of cultural norms, right? I just think it would be a big step forward to encourage people to have those conversations, about consent. But if you think you're going to have good sex, either morally or physically, just because somebody consented to it, that's ridiculous. That's silly. Right.
I wonder if finally we could return to the radical feminist view and your critique of that.
Okay.
We spoke about it a little bit earlier. But I mean, it's often understood this view, the radical feminist view of consent and rape, to entail this idea that in conditions of patriarchy, all consent is kind of so tainted because of, you know, inequality, because of, you know, lack of genuine free choice, that all heterosexual sex is in some sense a rape, you know, or is in some sense a kind of a violation. And I wondered if you could kind of clarify, you know, for me, do you think that is the view? Do you think that's kind of a fair representation of the view? It's one that I hear kind of bandied around. And then do you think that's a helpful way of thinking about, you know, a lot of this problematic kind of coercive type sex as, I mean, McKinney says, politically I call it rape. She then says, I don't want to put everybody in prison for that, but politically I call it rape. You know, this is all much of a muchness, almost, seems like the idea.
I think it's possible to make sense of the radical critique of consent without reaching the reductio ad absurdum conclusion that all heterosexual sexes should be criminalized. And that is what she was doing when she was talking about the over-inclusiveness of consent, the way that just about any sexual transaction, in my words, is understood as resting on express consent. Marital is the obvious example, but so is sex work. Implied consent, because of the way people are dressing, the slut whores thing, or hypothetical consent, that you're just assumed to have consented to sex because of your particular faith. I mean, remember, in the Catholic Church, to withhold sex from your husband is a greater sin than it is for him to go get sex, whether consensually or not, with some outsider. So withholding of sex was regarded as the greatest sin. So that's an example of what I would call hypothetical consent, that the sex is hypothesized as having been given at the altar. That makes it express, but as implicit in the role, right? If it's implicit in the role of being married, it might also be implicit in the role of being in a cohabitation relationship, or in a relationship, or on a date, or as part of sex work. And then that makes you sort of unrapeable. So much of what she said was about that phenomenon, was about the way in which consent is presumed so widely that it's just unworkable. I mean, she never used that word, but I think that's what she meant, that it's unworkable as a divide between consensual and non-consensual, between rape and legal sex. And what she wanted to say instead was that in some very important sense, yes, all, that's why she said yes in that context, all heterosexual sex is rape, because it's all coercive, because the culture mandates that women always want it, that women always desire it, that women always say yes to it, that that's what women are for. And so what she wound up concluding was that you shouldn't use it as a criteria, you should use force as the criteria. And there's problems with using force. But to get back to the more global claim, one reason for the disconnect between what she was saying and I think what she meant and the way she was heard, and it was often because of the way she was expressing it, right, was that is this. There's a common phrase used, right, among critiques of capitalism that all property is theft.
Right.
Right. I mean, you hear that bandied about. And so no one understands that, I don't think, as meaning that everybody that owns even a sliver of property should be in jail for theft crimes.
Right. They understand it to be a political statement.
That it's a political slogan and it's a metaphor. Okay. But in a time period in which other groups of feminists are trying to expand the definition of rape, the definition of what's illegal, so as to include a lot of sort of amorphous things that not everybody can get their head around, to say something that is heard as all sex is rape, in contrast to saying all property is theft, doesn't have an anchored set of meanings, right? So that if you're saying all sex is rape while another group is trying to expand the definition of rape to include a lot of sex that previously wasn't rape, it sounds like it's not so crazy to think that you actually mean that all of this sex should be illegal in some way. Not necessarily criminal, but illegal in some way. And I think that's where the disconnect was.
But your view is that, you know, regardless of this question about criminalization and what we should call rape, is also that there are very different harms associated with, say, you know, sex that is consented to, but in these kind of broadly socially coercive circumstances.
Yeah.
Sex that is rape, right, in that it involves the literal overpowering of a person, you know, whether physically or with kind of coercive threats that amount to
Correct. So there's two problems with the radical feminist critique of all heterosexuality, basically. One is that it makes more difficult the liberal feminist movement, as well as theoretical move, to try to expand the definition of rape to include some forms of sex that people previously had not understood as rape or as deserving of criminal sanction. It just confuses things hugely. But the second is that in some ways, it's just over-inclusive. As I said before, there are sexual relationships, sexual encounters, marriages, relationships, and all the rest of it that are morally unproblematic, that that get swept in if one ties the critique solely to power imbalances, because power imbalances, again, are pervasive. I mean, you have to look pretty hard to find somebody who's at exactly your level. And so to return to the school context, I remember when all this was being bandied about in the 80s in terms of writing codes of what's sexually permissible and not on university and college campuses. And some of the complaints were coming from people who were in liberal arts colleges in rural settings, rural America, where it was your only, I mean, that's the dating pool. And so the thought was, look, as long as you avoid students who are either, you know, under 18 or who are undergraduates, define it however you want, as long as you avoid the population that really is at risk of being exploited, and avoid relationships with your direct underlings, whether they're students or your graduate assistants or your research assistants, whatever, it shouldn't be regulated at all. And that struck me as sensible. It still strikes me as sensible. And I think that where we got to the point of over-regulating sex between people at different levels of hierarchies, but who are not impacting each other. It's the same in a large workforce. If you're just at a higher rung and you want to have a relationship with a co-employee who's not in your jurisdiction at all, over whom you don't really directly exercise power, but you do have more institutional power, that starts looking over-inclusive.
Robin West, thank you very much for this conversation.
Okay, well, thank you, Kate. Thanks for inviting me, and I enjoyed it very much.